Yeah.
Okay, good morning. Welcome to our public session of the GPF meeting. And I suppose we don't have any new GPF members, nobody introduced. We have Trent. Welcome. And I think we can also introduce April and Therese. Therese is not here. April is doing the job ISA has done for the GPF, so helping us setting the agenda and also helping us in preparing that meeting and all that. Welcome, April. Therese is not here. She's also helping us to organize that. And having that said, also in absence, thank you, ISA, for all the contribution for so long years and a good job done. Having that said, I think we can enter into the agenda, and first is ISB update, and I give the word to Michelle.
Thank you. So I used a similar format to I used at the last GPF meeting because nobody complained about it, so hopefully this is the right format. So I've started off by just listing things that we will be issuing in a final form this year. So on slide three, there are two projects that we expect to issue this year. The first is the classification of liabilities of current and non-current. And this was an ED that the board issued some time ago and then brought back more recently. So what we will issue, or what the board has now tentatively decided to issue, is an amendment to IS1, which will help entities with the classification of current and non-current. So it will provide clarification in IFRS1 that an entity has the right at the reporting date to defer settlement for at least 12 months. And so that assessment will be at the reporting date, and the board will clarify that that won't be affected by management's expectation. The board will also do some clarification around the classification of liabilities with equity features. And we are also going to issue an exposure draft on IBOR, so the interest rate reforms, and we hope also to issue the amendment to that as well this year. So we'll look at that one later, that project later on. And then on slide four, I've listed out the consultation documents that we are working on at the moment, so the main consultation documents. And what I propose is to provide an overview of the consultation documents and the projects that we are not, that are not on the GPF's agenda, so that we can pick up the more detailed points that you might have on those projects in those project update sessions. And we have now started our comprehensive review of the IFRS for SMEs, but we wouldn't be planning to bring that to this group because we have a specialist group that look after that project. In terms of our maintenance projects, there is out for comment at the moment a proposed amendment to IS 37 to provide some clarification on provisions for onerous contracts, and we've got a session on that later on today. And then there are a list there of exposure drafts that we anticipate issuing this year. So I'm just going to pick out a couple of those exposure drafts that we expect to issue this year. So the first one I was going to pick out is the deferred tax one. So the board are going to provide some relief from the exemption of recognising deferred assets and liabilities where you've recognised an asset and a liability. So this came up through the implementation of IFRS 16, but it would also deal with things like decommissioning, where you've got both the cost of the PPE and a corresponding liability. So where you recognise an asset and a liability, how you address the deferred tax. We, as part of the disclosure initiative, the board will also issue an amendment to IS1, just to say that you disclose your material accounting policies. Currently, IS1 says significant. And we will also add some illustrative examples to our practice statement on the application of materiality, which will demonstrate how to apply the process that's in the practice statement to selecting accounting policies to be disclosed. And then the other amendment that we will be proposing, I was going to pick up, was just the updating the references to the conceptual framework. So what we will, what the board are proposing to do is to issue an amendment that will propose just avoiding. So when we updated the conceptual framework, we didn't update the reference that is in IFRS 3 to the old conceptual framework. We will now update that reference, but because the reference, the conceptual framework has changed and the definition of assets and liabilities have changed, we'll just put some structure around that to make sure people only have to recognise liabilities that are already within the scope of IFRIC 21 or IS 37. So that'll effectively take us back to where we are now. Just on slide six, I've listed out some projects that we have issued project summaries on. So these are things that the board has either done some research on, where we issued an exposure draft on IFRS 8 and ultimately decided not to proceed with those proposals, or where we're just summarising the findings from a discussion paper. What we wanted to do was have somewhere where the board's thinking and analysis in those projects was documented, but because we hadn't gone and issued a final standard, there was no basis of conclusions. So they analysed the board's thinking. The one around IFRS 8 explains why we didn't proceed, what the findings were. Okay, so moving forward, I was just going to touch on business combinations under common control, which is at slide nine. So this is a project that we discussed last year with the GPF members, and what we discussed was the information requirements versus the cost and benefit. What the board has been looking at, or what the staff more have been looking at, and we've been coming to the board with education sessions, the board yet hasn't made any tentative decisions, is looking at the information needs of users and the different categories of information needs of users. So more recently, they've been discussing with lenders and creditors where you have a subsidiary that, but it has external borrowings, the information needs. So we've been talking to credit agencies and the such like. And what we're doing is considering whether the predecessor approach might be appropriate in certain circumstances. And we've also looked at, the staff have also looked at how the predecessor approach might be applied in those circumstances. So I don't know if you want to add anything, Peter.
On that one, okay. So the staff is going to bring some more materials to the board on business combinations under common control over the next 2 to 3 months. Gist of the staff's recommendations will be that for transactions in which we're focusing first of all on the receiving entity, so we're not talking about the top parent because that's already covered by the standards, we're talking about the receiving entity in the transaction. And we've identified three categories of transactions. So the first is where you have external lenders or other creditors but no non-controlling interest in the receiving entity. And in that case, the staff are going to recommend to the board that we use the predecessor method. The second case is where we have a reorganisation that's going on and with the aim of heading to an IPO subsequently, but no existing NCI in the receiving entity. And in that situation, the staff are also likely to recommend using the predecessor method. And then the third situation is where you have NCI in the receiving entity at the time of the business combination. And in that situation, the staff are likely to recommend using a current value method, which may be the acquisition method in IFRS 3 or may possibly need some tweaking. That's still up for further discussion. But that's the sort of general outline of what the staff are likely to recommend. As Michelle said, the board hasn't taken any decisions on any of that yet.
Can you explain why having NCI is what differentiates the accounting?
So it's a focus on what the user's needs are. And in looking at that, the controlling party has other access to information, so isn't really necessarily completely dependent on the financial statements. The NCI are in the situation, as is the case with shareholders in other business combinations, that they're receiving most of their financial information from the financial statements. They're dependent on that information. And so our conclusion is that as for other business combinations, the most useful information for the holders of NCI is current value information. Whereas in the other cases, we think they're either indifferent or in the case of some of the IPOs, it's actually unhelpful because you get updated current values in some parts, but not others. And the people who come in subsequently are not really interested in the history of how you get to where you are today.
I would be concerned over manipulation.
Yeah.
So I would have leaned towards predecessor method for all of them just because of that.
That's a factor we're looking at as well. And I think we'll be looking to say that there has to be some sort of substantive NCI there. So it's not just you've sort of got a couple of shares that have been issued for some kind of formal reason, but there's actually genuine substantive NCI there. What the staff are leaning towards is saying that if the NCI shares are listed, then that's substantive and that would be covered by that. We're looking at the possibility of some sort of opt-in or opt-out mechanism if it's unlisted. Mm-hmm. But it's to try and overcome, first of all, cost-benefit considerations, which obviously might be different if you've only got a small NCI, and secondly, possible concerns about manipulation.
Okay, so the next project and this is one that is occupying a lot of the board's time at the moment, is the primary financial statements project. And there's an overview provided in starting at slide 14. We had quite a long discussion with the GPF about the potential effects of this project at the December meeting. So what I was going to do was just provide an update on the board's discussions since then. And particularly, one of the points that the GPF members made was on the management performance measures and the board's proposals to show the tax effects for and NCI effects on those management performance measures. So the staff are going to do a sweep issue and bring that topic back to the board based upon your feedback. But the board also spent some time in November and December discussing whether EBITDA was a management performance measure. And so on slide 19, the board has set out how the disclosures around management performance measures and how they should be presented in the financial statements. And then there was a discussion around whether EBITDA was a management performance measure and how it and what should be disclosed around that. So the board's tentative decisions is that it will say that it will provide a definition of EBITDA being the board's definition of operating profit plus depreciation and amortization. But this in itself, they won't define as a management performance measure, which would mean that there would be no requirement in this instance to show the reconciliation for tax effects and NCI. So that was the board's decisions in December. In February, the board discussed the performance statement for financial entities and the board's proposals are set out on slide 13, I think. They're set out on slide 17. And then in March, the board have made some decisions on separate presentation for goodwill, integral and non-integral investments. And the board also discussed aggregation and disaggregation and how it will provide some guidelines around how to aggregate and disaggregate. So what the board is proposing is that for all transactions and other events, an entity will decide which, whether it's an asset, a liability, equity, income, or other expense, put it in, and from those, it will then separate out each of those and decide, based upon the characteristics, how it should be presented in the primary statements, and then look at the disclosures. And the board has also done some work on unusual and infrequent items in the March meeting as well, and will provide some guidance around what is an unusual item. And at this time, the board's tentative decisions are that an unusual item will be an income and expense that has limited predictive value, because it's reasonable to expect that it won't, that similar items won't arise in future reporting periods. I don't know if anyone has any questions on that project.
Sandra?
And the unusual and infrequent events, having worked at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for a number of years and some of the restrictions with that, one of the things we constantly struggled with was companies' interpretation of infrequent events or unusual events were things that happened year in and year out. They would look at restructurings as unusual events, and you know, what do you really mean by that? It was constantly an area that the regulators were struggling with companies and how they presented that. So I just wonder, is it really going to be able to work if you've got regulators that will interpret it differently, and can the definition be tight enough to not pull in all the negative things that happen and exclude all the gains that are happening in financial statements?
It is a difficult area, and I can see what you're saying, but I think at least by providing some form of definition, we'll be able to work through. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question.
Yeah, no, I agree.
When the staff try to make it more principle-based, it, if these items don't have a predictive value for future earnings, this is the underlying principle, mm-hmm. and then coming up with some definition what that means. And clearly, it would not be a very robust definition, which I think can then resolve all the kind of issues. Mine in the board discussion, I also mentioned what your concerns, and there is a discussion, but I think there is overall a strong need, and users told us, okay, that it is really what they want. And if you look at non-GAAP measures, mine, that is, I think in most of the cases, kind of an issue what people think, okay, because if you think what users want, they want to think what is the predictive earnings, and I think that is input in the evaluation models, and say, okay, we can't do that, maybe is a way, because we cannot clear a clear definition, but I think that is a kind of an attempt now to come up with a principle-based definition, and then I think how it works. That will be exposed, and people can comment on that, but I think it is a kind of a strong need, what users told us, okay, what they want, because it was in the discussion paper of the disclosure initiative. Feedback. Christoph?
Can I follow on? Is that right?
Just
a comment. I think I agree with Sandy, and the challenge that you will have is that this area will probably become more regulated by the local bodies, compliance bodies and so on, rather than the ISB. So it's just a comment. I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yeah.
I think the unusual items, it's easier if they are unusual by nature than if they are unusual by amount. So the idea that I close a particularly large customer contract and now need to assess, do I expect to close further contracts of the same size in the foreseeable future, what is the amount that I expect to contract? Because a user, if I tell the user I just closed a 10 million contract, I don't think I will close another 10 million contract in the foreseeable future, but 25 million contracts. So ITI Info alone, I don't think I will close yet another 10 million contract, useful piece of information, if it is not coming with, well, if you don't expect, what is it you expect? And on top, of course, very difficult to assess if I have such a contract, whether I think there will be another one coming. And that's why I think if it's unusual by amount, you would need to say which portion of the amount is the unusual portion and which is the usual portion, and then it's getting, I think, very, very difficult. One question that I will have is on classification of interest income. I don't know whether I misunderstood the slides, but from the slides it sounded to me as for the purpose of the income statement, interest on cash equivalents would be deemed as financing, so a negative financing expense, while for the purpose of the cash flow statement, it would be investing income or investing cash flow. Yeah. And I just wondered, I couldn't get my hands around why I would have the classification different, in this case, different for the P&L than for the cash flow statement. And on top, if I think of the P&L, it would then be if I put my money into the bank for 3 months, the interest would be investing, would be financing. If I put it in for 4 months, the interest would be investing, yeah. Which I found strange. And then if you think that the cash equivalent is more a cash flow notion, in the cash flow statement, I don't do this differentiation. So I struggled with that a bit, but
yeah, no,
I completely misunderstood it.
No, you didn't misunderstand it. That is the tentative decisions. And my understanding is when we were looking at the performance statement, there was this discussion that we've had several times about cash and cash equivalents and excess cash and cash equivalents. And the board's decision was that they wanted to have a pure profit before financing activities. So the interest on cash and cash equivalents was put below, whereas the feedback we got around the cash flow statement was it was difficult to do the categorization, and therefore we put it in the investing activities. So there is there isn't consistency between the two statements, but it was based upon specific reasons. But as Martin says, this will go out for comment. Maybe something you want to read. Okay.
And my final comment will be on slide 19, where it is about changes in management performance measures over time. Maybe unusual for a preparer, I would hold a strong view that if these changes occur, you should either apply IAS 8, as you do for a change in accounting policy by restating prior period, mm-hmm. or, which is a little bit softer version, is what you do in IFRS 8, if you've got changes in segments, where it tells you should restate prior period. If not possible, then provide the prior definition numbers for the current period. I would struggle with seeing companies having these changes, explaining them, but without providing information that allows people to make a decent comparison of the numbers of different periods. And I think I like the IFRS 8 approach. It gives you some flexibility, because sometimes it's a change where it's really difficult to provide prior period numbers. And if you have that for the segment reporting, and usually the management performance measures are not that different on a segment level than they are on a company level. So to think that companies would do this on a segment level but not do the same for their management performance measure on company level, although it is the same number, I would find that odd.
Ian?
Yeah, thanks. A few points. I mean, I would encourage that the primary financial statements is almost like a standing topic at these meetings, because I think there's a lot that can be said on many of these topics. I think I picked out two things: the unusual items topic. I would totally echo. When I read that, I just thought I wonder how that's even going to be enforceable. And it can have unforeseen consequences. So, for example, one can debate whether restructuring expenses are or are not unusual, but what's definitely clear is readers want to know about them, and they want to know how much companies are spending on them, and they want to know where they are in the balance sheet, in the income statement, so they can do their analysis. So if a very prescriptive rule is put out that says these things are not unusual, for me, as the preparer, that's easier. I just put, say, the whole page of disclosure, and the readers then don't know anything. So actually, they get less information. So I think there's a lot of points to be considered here. We can debate whether restructuring expenses should be in and out of non-GAAP measures. That's one topic. But whether readers want to know about them, regardless of where they are, I think there's not a debate about that. And I think we need to be very cognizant of that. And this is one of the areas where I think, you know, this is the kind of topic where everyone in this room has views that I think would be of use to the ISB. And it's a bit unfortunate we're a bit pushed for time. I have one specific question on slide 17 on the... I'm not a bank, so I don't have a particular dog in this fight, but are you giving people the choice there, or will there be, in circumstance A, you do this, and in circumstance B, you do that, or is it just a free choice?
It's an or. It's an or.
I still didn't hear you, sorry.
It's a choice.
It's a free choice. I would encourage you to reconsider that. Please do one or do the other. If there are certain circumstances where certain people should do this under defined conditions, that's fine. But on primary financial statements, I think users want to have some clarity and some comparability. And if you just give the preparers a straight choice for no reason than personal preference, I really think that's not helpful. As I said, I don't have a particular cat in that fight, but I just think that's a very directionally the wrong way to go.
Okay.
So the other significant topic that we've been working on is the goodwill and impairment project, and I think we have previously discussed with you how we've reset our objectives, and there are now three areas that we're looking at in this project: the disclosures, simplifying maybe the accounting for goodwill, and then improving the value of calculation in use. So the staff has been analysing the feedback that you provided last time on the proposed disclosures, and also outreaching to others on those disclosures. I think generally we've had some quite positive feedback about those disclosures, and we will bring proposals to the board on those. The staff have also been looking at, and I think accumulating the arguments that support the amortization of goodwill and those that don't support the amortization of goodwill, and they will bring those arguments to the board at a future meeting. And I think we've discussed improving the value of the calculation in use at the previous meeting. I don't know if Peter wants to add anything. No. So then I suggest, in the interest of time, we just look at IBOR and what the proposal.
Maybe one quick comment on slide 24. I think as a preparer, you've got to make this comment. Is elimination of disclosure that are not useful not part of it, or is it somehow in one of the items? Because revisiting disclosures should not only be about enhancing and adding, but also about revisiting whether any of the endless number of disclosures in IFRS 3 is not as useful as it may have been thought to be when the original standard was. But and slide 24 doesn't appear to show that. Yeah. It creates a notion of we add, but I think that would be only half of the story.
So
I guess it may be in this perform a limited review, but to spell it out explicitly, if you spell out explicitly enhancing and adding, then revisiting and elimination should be spelled out explicitly as well.
We discussed with the board how wide that review should be, and the board's message was that the review of the existing disclosure should be very limited. So I think we wouldn't be looking to any great extent at eliminating existing disclosures at the moment.
So you would really develop additional?
Yep.
That's limited enough? Yep. And enhance existing, but not eliminating?
I think the enhancing of the existing is linked very much to the objective A that's in the slide. And the board wasn't enthusiastic about reopening all of the rest of the disclosures in IFRS 3.
Do you think probably this later on today we're going to be talking about the standards disclosure review, and we can probably pick that point up in that session as well, if that's helpful. Okay.
Christoph's point is very well. I mean, just for awareness of the ISB, in the wider preparer community, when the ISB says improve, we read it as expand. Mm-hmm. Just to take it on board, and there is a lot of disclosure here already, and I appreciate you're just sort of communicating the message, but this is, there is a lot there already, and it can be improved. No one disputes that, and what we are doing now doesn't work. It doesn't give users what they want. You can debate about the debits and credits that are going in, and you can debate about the disclosure. It doesn't work, and therefore, I think everybody will be open to discuss to add some new things or put some new things in, but there, at the same time, there has to be a discussion about taking some of the other stuff out and stopping doing some of the things that actually people don't use and they don't work. We had a 2 billion goodwill impairment in our last results. We got precisely zero questions from analysts on this.
Maybe your disclosure was good.
Sorry?
Maybe your disclosure was good.
I think our disclosure is fairly good. I'm not sure it's finding its way into any best practice documents. Okay. So let's put it that way.
First N.
Just on this disclosure point, it is part of other changes to IFRS 3. We're sensitive to always asking preparers to do more, but we're also looking at other modifications in response to concerns about recognition and measurement. So even though this slide just talks about the disclosures, in terms of the IFRS 3 work, there is other work that is responding to comments preparers have made to us about the recognition and measurement process.
I understand that, but I took Peter's comment to be that we wouldn't be reducing.
Well, and maybe I should actually amplify that as well, because I think the board was quite keen to keep the discussion paper as focused as possible so we get the best possible input, and so we don't overload it with discussion of other issues, so that there's nothing to say that we couldn't come back to look at considering removing some of the disclosures at the next stage, but the board didn't want to include that discussion in the discussion paper.
So we have already 15 minutes ahead of time.
Just a quick question on slide 23. Objective A, B, C, I mean, if all the objectives are to be considered as collective objective, then objective B, there's an and or indicator only, and or introduce amortization of goodwill. Now, if it is indicator only, then only objective A becomes relevant. I think if it is B, second alternative, then it is not relevant. Secondly, the objective B, how can it be and or? Does it mean that it will be a choice of the entity to adapt indicator only or amortization of goodwill?
So if I can answer that. So the board is going to ask both of those questions, and there may or may not be a link between them, but the board hasn't reached a sort of final tentative decision on those yet anyway. So it might be they adopt one, or they might be adopt both, or they might adopt neither. That's still to be discussed.
All options are open now, yep, at this moment.
Bruno?
Given the intention regarding the improvement of disclosures and increasing adding more disclosures, I would just like to make a request for attention to the cost of these additional disclosures if the idea is not to give up on all the disclosure requirements. Because the marginal cost of additional disclosures, should be increasing if you don't give up on all disclosure requirements.
And only to explain it, after the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 and especially of this impairment model, the user said, okay, that is so, even if we have an impairment, maybe what you all said, okay, there is confirmatory value because people already knowing that. But they want to make to more current information on if the acquisition is successful, yes or no. And that is what we concentrate really on regarding to give more disclosure, because we don't find any, I think, measurement and recognition criteria which will give that to the users. And therefore, I think the solution could be maybe a better disclosure on this element, how the subsequent performance of an acquisition is. And that is what we discussed already in December, and that is not a kind of extending disclosure. It is a kind of, based on the post-notation review, that was the most important thing, what users told us, what they want. And I think all the discussion what we had in December confirmed, okay, that you guys also think that maybe an impairment is not so kind of information value, because people already knowing that, it's confirmatory, and what people really are interested, and even when I saw last year Ian's presentation about goodwill disclosure, I think that is really, we try to improve what is really of interest from users. And that is, I think, the focus of this more disclosure. But I think we, in the interest of time, we cannot discuss that today. Maybe I will ask the team to have it for the next meeting, because I think, is that fine? Okay.
So I think the only project we just need to perhaps mention is the IBOR project, and then I think we can probably close this
session.
Let me
say maybe some words. You all know, okay, that we have the IBOR reform, and there are several questions also relating to accounting, and the board has said, okay, how can we be helpful? And we said, okay, there maybe are two kind of phases for this kind of project. First was a kind of, we have several requirements in the hedge accounting literature, which is saying, okay, you must be kind of certain qualitative criteria to apply hedge accounting, and IBOR reform can have an impact on that, and especially then on the certainty of your cash flows, which you take into consideration for this qualitative assessment. And the board has debated that now two times. We have finalized that, and we will come up with an exposure draft with a comment period of 45 days, because it's kind of a little bit of urgency, because this reform will starting, and people asking that question because it's this kind of prospective assessment of this hedge accounting. Then the second phase is more, we have not debated it, but there could be a second phase, what really happening, for example, on existing hedges, if they are modified because of the IBOR reform. And then the question is, okay, what does it mean for existing hedges? Is it a kind of derecognition? Is it modification? And what are the consequences of hedge accounting? And we are currently not able to address it, because we don't know what is happening in the market out of this IBOR reform, how hedges or the hedged item are adjusted, but we are prepared, if we get further information on that, that we then enter into phase two and then trying to helping if it is possible to doing that. But I think the overall common sense was, okay, we will not throughout this simplification or things, okay, to enter really economic substance of the transaction, we want maybe helping in more or less of this qualifying criteria. Having said that, as this 45 days current period, a comment period already said, so that we are expecting maybe by end of second quarter, okay, that we maybe have that in place. There are no banks, because they have questions. But okay, having said, then we finish this ISB update, and